who is your king? Let's open Matthew's gospel together, shall we? It'd be useful to have it in front of you, if you've got it. Because I want to give some more thought to this passage we've been reading, because I think that the truth is that knowing and living the Christian life is not straightforward, it's not easy, it's not plain sailing. There's all sorts of challenges and difficulties that you as a Christian face to live out the Christian life properly in this world. And I just want to reassure you that that's quite normal. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it is. And this passage really speaks to us about that. A couple of weeks ago, I was preaching here a message about Christmas. I was really dealing with the complexities of Christmas. Christmas is complicated, and I was talking about that, about the complexities of what this celebration, this Christmas, is all about. And it is the last of our national holidays. There is no other rival, is there, in this day and age? One thing that everybody basically gets involved with. So we were talking about that. But as we look this morning, because that time we were really coming from the book of Luke, the account in Luke. This morning we're looking in the account of Matthew. And you'll see that both of the gospel writers, the gospel writer Luke and the gospel writer Matthew, both have this in common. They both set their account of Jesus' birth against a dark backdrop. And that's quite important to notice. The first backdrop that Luke gives us is the intense poverty of Christ. You think of Christ the King, but Luke wants to show you that Christ the King was born in a stable. He had no room, there was no room in the inn. He's on the outskirts, he's an outcast. And he wants to show you Christ's identification with the poor, with the lowly, with the humble, with the broken, with the outsider, with the leper, with those who are suffering, those who are excluded. Christ's sufferings begin with his birth. Christ, coming from the realms of glory, begins to suffer from his birth. And Matthew's account also sets Christ's birth against a dark background. This glorious light, these lights that are shining, these angels that are singing, these gifts that are brought from these exotic parts of the world, all these wonderful things. Christ is born, wonderful, wonderful things, but it's set against a dark background. That's partly why we all enjoy the stars at night, isn't it? When we look up at the stars at night, the intense velvety darkness of the background sets all these things off and makes them glorious to our eyes. But the dark side, if you will, of Christmas, that as Matthew tells it, is quite different to the way that Luke tells us. By the way, on Tuesday, for those of you coming to Christmas, I promise I'll just be nothing but sweetness and light, all right? Nothing but sweetness and light. But it's important to look at this because this is the way the Bible tells us the story. You know, sometimes I hear people out there, perhaps people who are skeptical or cynical about the Christian faith, and they look at Christmas and they see that something about Christmas is very saccharine, it's all sweetness, it somehow lacks some substance or contrast that makes it true to life. Because we all know that life is not like that. It's not just all sweetness and light. And Matthew, as he tells his account of Christ's birth, he sets it against a dark background too, but not the poverty of Christ. He wants us to think about something else. If I was trying to tell you in broad terms what Matthew is trying to achieve when he writes his letter to us, what he wants us to think about, he wants us to think about the kingdom of heaven. He wants to think about the kingdom of heaven, and that's why he's introducing at the beginning the king, the kingship of Christ. Because he wants us to think about the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Christ. And you have to remember that all these books, these gospels, are otherwise known that the writers are called the evangelists, the four evangelists. And this is not TV American evangelism. But this is a real, genuine, heartfelt attempt in the writing of these accounts of Jesus' life to wrestle with the hearts and minds of the people who hear these stories. And to convince them of the claims of Christ, to persuade them that they might believe what otherwise they may see as being unbelievable, or that they may be too afraid to believe, that the life challenges they face might be so overwhelming, the pressures they're under so overwhelming, social pressures, family pressures, political pressures, religious pressures that they might be under might be so overwhelming that they would just stay where they are and not believe. And Matthew, as he writes, he's persuading them, believe. He wants you to believe that Christ is the King and that the kingdom has come. And to take this Christ as your King, that you might put your trust in him, that you might obey him, that you might follow him in this world. Look at the gospel. Look at the second chapter. You only have to read down three lines. Just read the first two or three lines to yourself, and you'll see that already Matthew is painting the picture of that there's a problem. Trusting Christ is problematic. Knowing Christ is challenging and difficult. Why? Because already, by the time you've reached the third line, you can see there's only one kingdom, but there's two kings. There's two kings. There's King Herod seated on the throne, and King Jesus in the manger, in a stall in Bethlehem. One kingdom, two kings. And you can see from the beginning, there is a potential chemistry here for disaster, and conflict, and trouble and trials. Now, I want to think a little bit about Herod, if I may. I'm talking about the dark side. Christmas, the dark side. Herod, he's the baddie of all the mystery plays, isn't he, Herod? But, you know, he was an incredibly efficient monarch. Very, very efficient monarch. I mean, he had one of the most complicated political situations on his hands. I mean, you think of Mohammed Karzai and out in Afghanistan. I think this was tougher. He had the Romans to satisfy on the one hand. He had the Parthians on the border on the other hand. He had internal splits and factions and fightings in his own people. Everybody was a militant. Nobody had soft views. There was no such a thing as a liberal party. All right? They were all fanatics, it seems. And he had to try and keep some sort of a control on the whole thing. And in the midst of all the complications that this man Herod faced, he was industrious to a level that probably has established his name through history. He built palaces and amphitheaters. He built colosseums. He built ports and navigational channels. He built aqueducts. He built fortresses. He built palaces. The man was just building beautiful, fantastic buildings all over the country. Absolutely remarkable industry this man had. And so you can see when somebody is doing so well and is being so productive that it's kind of embarrassing when you look in chapter 1, verse 2, that a group of foreigners, these Magi, they were foreigners, they'd come from abroad, they'd come from probably Iraq now, which was on the other side of the frontier of the Roman Empire into the Parthian Empire. These people were very much part of the other world, the Great East. They turn up in the city of Jerusalem, and they start to say, "Where's the king?" Now, if you were king at the time and somebody starts walking around the city going, "Can you show me where the king is, please?" They say, "Well, this is the temple, and here is his palace, and there's his fortress, and there's his aqueduct." Nobody could be more prominent. Nobody was more prominent than King Herod. And there are these people saying, "Excuse me, does anybody see, is there a king?" You can see how this might irk somebody. That it might press somebody's buttons, that it might offend somebody's pride. And if that person truly, because oftentimes the people who appear most confident often are actually deeply insecure. And if this man Herod is indeed what we believe, a deeply insecure man whose rule and reign is actually teetering on the brink of disaster all the time, then this sense that there is some other power, some other authority, deeply troubles him. And when some people have said maybe the Bible's been a little bit unfair on Herod because Herod, well, you know, he did so much. I looked in the Catholic Encyclopedia the other day and I looked up an account of his life, and it described him, and I thought this was a very pithy little phrase. An evil genius was the phrase that they used, which made me think somewhat, whoever wrote the Encyclopedia had just been putting down James Bond or something like that. The evil genius. Herod the evil genius. But I've had the privilege of being able to travel, as you know, into the Middle East and go around to a lot of the places that Herod built. And I have to say, there is something rather James Bond about this guy. There really is. Has anybody here been to Masada or heard of Masada? You've been recently, haven't you? What an amazing opportunity you had. Now, isn't Masada the most bizarre place? It's just a bit of rock sticking out of the desert, flat rock, yes? And then there's two almost inaccessible platforms that you could only really get to if you've got the hidden passwords, and that's where Herod had his palaces, wasn't it? Sort of perched out on these juts of rock. It was something out of James Bond, isn't it? Fair to say. And then he also had his own mega palace within Jerusalem. So Jerusalem had fantastic walls all around it. Then within the walls, there was a fortress within the fortress that was his own personal palace. So he had Masada, his rock escape. Then he had this fantastic palace in Jerusalem as well that he built. He also, down in Jericho, did you go to Jericho as well? Down in the desert and all the palm trees, and that's where he had his pleasure palace. That's where all the music happened and all the feasts and all that sort of thing. He loved high living, and that all happened down there in Jericho. So he had this pleasure palace, a bit like Las Vegas. He had his own little Las Vegas out in the desert as well. And then he also had Caesarea down by the sea. Seaport, it's nice to have a place by the sea as well, isn't it, you know? But the real value of that is because that's where he could meet the Romans who used to come and go by the sea routes. And he built this fantastic sort of Romanesque city there with theatres and sports arenas, you know, Wembley Stadium and all that sort of thing. Fantastic there. But the real secret of it is he always kept a ship there loaded with gold. So if he needed to make an escape, he could jump aboard and he was away. Just like James Bond, you know, the pod comes out and the boat comes out and off he goes into the desert, right? Or on the sea. He was like that. Did you go to Herodion? Did you go to Bethlehem? You didn't go to Bethlehem. Okay. Well, you could, from Jerusalem, you can actually see, if you look down towards the desert into the south, you can actually probably see the top of Herodion. Herodion is the most bizarre of all his architectural feats. He basically built this false mountain. He built a mountain. It just looks like a regular mountain, but it's completely false. And he just cut the top off the top, and he buried down inside the top of this mountain, and he built his palace inside the heart of this. It's like a volcano, you know, just like it's proper James Bond, Dr. No stuff. So he had this palace hidden inside what looked like a volcano. And this was his power and control center. This was his private residence. This is where he had all his buttons and his gadgets and his things. And from there, he could actually see Jerusalem. And so he could keep an eye on what was going on there. He could see Masada, so he could keep an eye on what was going on there. He could see Bethlehem from there as well. He could see and control and all these sort of things. And that's where he had his main base with palaces and colonnades and all this sort of thing. Absolutely remarkable. Just 3 miles from Bethlehem. And likely as not, when Jesus is being born in Bethlehem, you could see across where the king was. The two kings were so close, they were within about 3 miles of each other. And you get an insight into what this man was like. Oh, by the way, the land that stands between Herodion and Bethlehem is called Bet-Zahor, which means the shepherd's fields. So, you know, all the shepherds, they're in the gap between where Herod was and where Jesus was, caught in the gap. And they had a choice which way they go. Which king are they going to worship? Who are they going to go and pay their tributes to? Who is your king? That's the kind of question that Matthew wants us to think about. I mean, look at Matthew chapter 2 and verse 3, and you can see the effect that the news about Jesus had on Herod. And everybody was bothered. Everybody was troubled. In the whole of Jerusalem. Why was Jerusalem troubled by the fact that these Magi had turned up saying that there was another king? Because they knew what Herod was like. They knew what he would do. They knew the terror he would unleash, his paranoia, his determination to rule and keep everybody under the thumb. That was the kind of man he was. All of Jerusalem, Herod would be disturbed. I have this picture of him in Herodion, like a dragon asleep under his mountain, sleeping on his pile of gold. And then this news comes that there's another king. He's rising up. And then in verse 7, as he calls the Magi together, he calls them together secretly. They say that Herod ruled the country by a network of spies and espionage. I mean, this is like, you know, the sort of the, in Russia when you had the secret services. Everything was, no, but you couldn't trust your neighbor. You couldn't trust anybody. You didn't know who was going to tell on you, who was going to turn you in, because they were jealous of you, because they wanted your business. They would just report you. People were getting taken away in the middle of the night. And in verse 8, you see, as he talks to the Magi, he says, oh, tell me news of where this king is that I can come and worship him. It's just lies, isn't it? This is the kind of king that was ruling and reigning when Jesus was born. Can you just put yourself in that position for a moment? You can think of countries in the world today, people in the world today who are living in situations that are like that, where people just oppress them. They're oppressed and controlled by paranoid and determined people like that. And even people, other Jews at that time, there's a man called Josephus who's writing at the same time as roughly Herod's life, a little bit later. I mean, you'd think that maybe he'd be more sympathetic because he wasn't a Christian himself, but he said that Herod was a daily avenger and punisher of all his enemies. Anybody who put their head above the parapet. He made it his daily business to go about avenging himself on them and punishing them. And I think you can read between the lines what that was all about. And that's the background to all this. That's the point I'm trying to say. The background to all this light and joy and goodness is this horrendous atmosphere. Black, dark atmosphere. Christ comes at night. Comes to a dark world. When it says that in the carols, it's not exaggerating. I was reading in one of the other encyclopedias, and this was a Jewish encyclopedia. Again, you'd think in the modern Jewish that Herod did so much for the Jewish people at that time that he'd be a hero. He says, this was a man who was willing to commit any crime to gratify his unending ambitions. And in another place it said he was a madman who murdered his own family. And he murdered many rabbis as well. Murdered his wife, murdered some of his children. That's the king. That's the king. That's the one who's ruling. That's the one who's reigning. In every way, he was just like the Romans, utterly merciless. But you'd think, well, maybe the Romans thought a lot of him because he was, after all, a Roman client king. He was put on the throne by the Romans to control the country on their behalf. Augustus was the great emperor at the time. Let me read you what Augustus, who was a pretty ruthless guy himself, said about Herod. He said, I would rather be Herod's pig than his son. Ouch. So, talking about the dark side. Talk about the dark side, the background to Christ coming. Where does Christ appear? He doesn't come. Not only does he come in all that poverty, he comes so undefended, so naked, so small, so vulnerable, in a time of such intense darkness and danger. It's like planting him into the center of the war zone, into the heart of darkness. And when the news gets to Herod, we're not surprised what we read in verse 16. When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi when his plans had failed, we read he was furious, rage, he was unleashed. Demonic hatred, demonic violence. And as you read through verse 16, there's that little episode there that we remember, and when we read it, it disturbs and troubles us so deeply, especially at Christmas time. It's the time of children, that in the same time, in the same Bethlehem where Christ was born, Herod also unleashed his fury in Bethlehem. And we read about the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem. That's the other side of Bethlehem. That's the other side of Christmas. People have accused Matthew of blackening Herod's name Surely he wouldn't have done something anything like this. But after everything I've told you about Herod, this account is pretty plausible, isn't it? You can believe that this man would indeed have done such a thing. I think it's partly not plausible in some people's minds because the exaggerated claims about the size of the massacre. I've read in one account they believe that 144,000 children were massacred at the thing. I think that is what you might call an exaggeration. Proper sort of more scientific estimates think that Bethlehem had 1,000 people living there and maybe 20 children died. But let me tell you, today 20 children died not so long ago in Connecticut, and we all are shaken to our very core. But I can see why it wouldn't arrive in the headlines and the day in which this was written, because the person who perpetrated this, yes, was a madman, just like the madman who perpetrated what happened in Connecticut. But this wasn't a madman, some vulnerable minor individual on the outskirts of society. The person who perpetrated this was the king. This was the kingdom. That was what the kingdom was like. And so when we read here that Matthew makes us aware of what happened, when he proclaims it, he is breaking all the taboos. He is saying things. He's speaking against, if you will, the government. He's stepping out of line. He's putting his head above the parapet. He is being brave. When you see the man in Tiananmen Square facing the tanks, when you see the people in the square in Tahrir Square in Egypt coming out against the troops, when you see people standing without very little protection, standing up for things that are right and for good, Matthew is standing up and saying, I'm going to tell you how it is. I'm going to tell you what the system is really like and what the system does to people. But I'm not going to just do that. I'm going to point you to one who, if you will trust and you will follow, will change your lives and the lives of everybody else who believes in him. And he points us to Christ the King. Now, it's certainly true that by the time he wrote this, when Matthew wrote this, Herod was already dead. We read that in verse 19, that he died just a short time afterwards. But his son who followed him, Archelaus, we read in verse 22, was just as bad, it seems. Joseph was terrified. Imagine if you were terrified to go back to your country, terrified to go back to your home, go back to your country because of the regime. That's what they were experiencing. But the truth was, as we're told here in this passage, that out of Bethlehem came the true king, not out of Herodion, not out of these palaces, not out of the mad system of Herod and his descendants, but out of Bethlehem, where King David himself was born, the son of David was arising, and the kingdom was coming. It says in some commentaries as well, how strange it is that this massacre is not described anywhere else in the New Testament. Well, why is that? Why don't they ever talk about that elsewhere? But I think if you turn into Revelations in chapter 12 and verse 4, you'll see that it is in rather much more hidden tones. Let's read from verse 1. It says, there was a great and wondrous sign appearing in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant, cried out in pain. She was about to give birth. And then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. And the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that he might devour her child at the moment it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Her child was snatched up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled to the desert, to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of 1,260 days. There may be all sorts of interpretations and meanings to that, but I don't think we can miss an account of the horror and the murderous intent that was brought to bear on Jesus Christ at the moment of his birth. There was a determined effort to kill the king, that only one king can rule in the kingdom. And there's a portrait there of Herod as part of some great monstrous antichrist rival to the true king. And I think, as I read this, I think what Matthew's trying to tell us is that Jesus is coming, this little baby's coming, is like an invasion. It's an invasion from heaven. Heaven has invaded the earth. This dark world, in this grip of this dark force and this dark power, and into this comes the first ray of light. Into this comes the commander of God's armies. Into this comes this little child who will live and rule and reign and overtake all that this man Herod and the others have done. It's a bit like Joshua who invaded the land of Canaan. Jesus, whose name is almost the same as his, invades the land and plants his foot firmly and begins to take possession of all that's him, all that's his. I suppose what I'm trying to say is to all of you is that there is a kingdom of darkness as well as there is a kingdom of light. And the kingdom of darkness is just ruled by people's vanity, by people's greed, by people's fear, by people's pride. It's ruled by sin. Ultimately, that is what the kingdom of darkness is governed by. Am I speaking about something that doesn't exist? Is this something I've invented, or is just found in the Bible, or is just in a book? Or do people live like this? Are people today living under the dominion of darkness? Are people enslaved to fear? Are they enslaved to sin? Are people living like that today? And the Apostle Paul, as he reflects on Jesus' life and he writes to the people in Colossae, he talks about them being rescued from the kingdom, from the dominion of darkness, from the rule of darkness. All this darkness that is concentrated around the time of Christ's birth. Paul wants us to know that we have been rescued from the darkness, that this incredible light that has been seen is the beginning of our liberation, that freedom has come. The power of sin, the power of death has been broken, that there's a new life. The king has finally come to the kingdom, and the darkness is being pushed back. And as he begins to write about the account, he makes this reference, doesn't he, in verse 18 to the words of the prophet Jeremiah about the brutal, horrendous things that happened as the kingdom was making its advance, the backlash, Herod's fury. And he says there's nothing new about this. It's been written about in the Bible from the beginning. Cain and Abel, right from the beginning, it's always been the same. If you find it hard to make progress, if you find it hard as a Christian to make progress, don't be surprised, because we are in a spiritual war. There is spiritual conflict. And those uncontrollable tears of the people in Bethlehem after Herod wreaked his revenge on the village, he says, is just like the people in the days of Jeremiah, who the Babylonians oppressed and repressed. But if you go there and you read in Jeremiah, you'll realize that what he's trying to tell them is that out of that, out of what seems impossible, out of the deepest, darkest moment in their history and in their lives, God was beginning to turn things around, and they would be comforted, and there was hope. And the kingdom was coming, and God is on their side, and he will not fail them. Herod died, Achillas died, Augustus died. They've all gone. All their empires are finished. Their palaces are in ruins. But Jesus is alive, and the kingdom continues. That which was started in the beginning, it's never going to end. And the way he writes this, he sets this, the murder of the children, he wants to make a point. It's just like the days when we were down in Egypt, when Pharaoh issued the decree that all our children should be thrown into the river Nile. But out of that, what came? Moses. The Exodus. The glory. The miracles. And so it is with Christ. That out of the darkest, out of the worst, came the most glorious. And that is the pattern of the table from which we're going to eat, isn't it? It's such a strange anomaly, isn't it? That people should come and celebrate the Lord's death. The Lord's death. Is there something perverse about the idea of coming to celebrate the Lord's death? No. Because out of his death comes life. Resurrection life. Forgiveness of sin. Hope of heaven. All the things that by our own efforts we couldn't hope to possibly attain are ours through the Lord's death. This is just the reality of life, that cheek by jowl, light and darkness, evil and good sit beside each other, and that is the way it is. It always has been. It's always been intense, and it always has been. And the question we're being asked by Matthew is, who do you serve? Who is your king? Who is your king? Who are you following? Who are you trusting? Who are you part of? Whose empire? Who's controlling you? Are you controlled by sin? Are you controlled by vanity and pride? Are you controlled by fear and unbelief and things that cannot achieve anything for you eternally, that just go with you to your grave? Or are you following King Jesus, who will take you through this world and into heaven and give you eternal life, eternal blessings, world without end? Don't think anything has changed. There are two kings at work in this world. There's only one kingdom. There's one world, people everywhere, all the good things. But there are two kings, aren't there? We've all got a choice to make. And as we come to the Lord's table this morning, we're challenging each of you to rededicate yourself, recommit yourself to following King Jesus, the one who came for us and humbled himself against such a background of darkness, and not just then, but all through the course of his life, even to the end, even to the cross, suffered in our place that we might have eternal life. So there's an invitation from one of the carols to be faithful, to follow him, to joyfully and triumphantly follow Christ through this world against the dark backdrop, irrespective of the dark, to walk, to whistle in the dark, if you will, and to keep following Jesus. Come joyful and triumphant. The shepherds came, the Magi's came. They came and they worshipped the real true King, who the Bible proclaims, Jesus the Lord.